Chapter 9. Your Tears Are Jewels. Having a Go at Telling My Own Story. Between existence and death, our lives are works in progress, unfolding like the lives of characters in an unfinished novel. While writing this book over a period of 2 years, I watched my own life moving forward, partially shaped by the writing itself, as well as by how clients, colleagues, pre-publication readers, and I converged upon each other's lives. Now that you have learned of so many of my clients' stories, perhaps you may wish to know more of my own life story. To that end, this chaplain encounter consists of an imaginary scenario where I am the one being chaplained, where the time has come for my own final chapter. I will grant myself a long life in this imaginary meeting and be 91 years old. I take this liberty because a mortality survey projected that I would live until around then. I have no argument with that. Given my family medical history, most likely I will have something wrong with my heart in my final days, but will be of sound mind. I picture myself living in my own home with my husband, as I do not wish to cede any control over my day, even though it means I will have to invest much more effort in maintaining social interaction. The hospice chaplain, highly experienced and board certified, that is, I have met my match, will be visiting me the day after tomorrow. I had said yes to her initial phone call asking if I would like a visit. I said yes because, if nothing else, I was curious about meeting a colleague. Curious and hungry for experiences to the last, I want to see what it will be like to be the one listened to in this situation, instead of the one listening. I always had wondered about that. Not that I was in any hurry to find out. I wonder what it will be like to answer her questions such as,
"When you look back at your life, what do you see?"
What will it feel like to have a chaplain say to me,
"How lost you must have felt before you found your place in the world?"
Or to answer questions like,
"What would you say were your most significant struggles, accomplishments, and pleasures? Why did you choose to be a hospice chaplain?"
What will I ask that chaplain, she said her name is Darlene, in return? Chaplain Darlene makes her first visit to me on a mild, breezy day in the late spring of 2049. The smaller branches on the dogwood tree out front are flapping around madly, while the heftier ones manage to hang on in a more dignified manner. A thunderstorm must be waiting in the wings. I can still walk, or ambulate, as hospice workers love to say, as a linguistic badge of professionalism. And I set out to answer the door, one of my many expeditions of the day. Due to shortness of breath, I head back to my easy chair as soon as I can, and I invite my guest to have a seat in the chair's twin. I mischievously tell her I want to give her fair warning that I had worked as a hospice chaplain myself. She deftly replies,
"Then I better not go with those stock responses like, 'What does it feel like for you to be telling me that?'"
I joke back, "Well, why not? And just think of what a great verbatim you could get out of this visit." There I go, funny till the end. She laughs, somewhat self-consciously, and probably is wondering what kind of ride she'll be getting. I remember my own sense of feeling presumptuous when I had to be a chaplain for any kind of clergy. Would a brown belt give lessons to a black belt karate master? However, as any good chaplain does, Darlene uses the fail-safe strategy of remaining quiet to see what I will choose to bring up next. I put off getting to anything too deep by doing what I normally do, which is to inquire all about the other person, resulting in my listening more and talking less. Then I think, to be honest, I tend to do this because so many times parents had not patiently listened to me, even when I had something pressing to say. So guarding against the disappointment of potentially not being heard, I just say, "I'd like to hear all about how you got interested in chaplaincy, about your training and all." She gives me a brief overview and then prompts,
"Rabbi Karen, tell me about your chaplain journey too. This is so inspiring to meet someone with your experience. It's so exciting to meet the author of a hospice memoir. And I do wonder, as you say in the book, what it's like for you now to be the one visited and not the visitor."
"You know about the book?" I pause to catch my breath. I knew the general public were afraid to hear about hospice, but in spite of themselves were curious enough to at least peer over my shoulder and see why we do work like this. Though I think there are plenty of other jobs out there I could never picture my own self doing, like being a proctologist or working in a poultry factory. Yet people do them, right? Darlene grins and says, "Uh-huh, And once again, Ken Intuit went to stay silent. Thank God she's not distracted and is tuned in to me. Anyway, I found my place in pastoral care. I found the sacred in the meeting space between me and the patients. They talked with me about what really mattered. There was more room for authenticity. Even right now, we have this great opportunity to talk about special things. I'm not one to do much small talk, though sometimes it is relaxing to do that. Like you, I too always have wondered what it would be like for me to be the one visited by a chaplain, be on the other side of the bed, so to speak. In the book, I wrote an imaginary meeting and got my wish in advance, though it sure is way different now from what I wrote then. Different? She asks as she leans forward, her glowing amber necklace hovering over her lap. How so? I think for a moment and reply. It was a little scary putting myself in that scenario, picturing myself being near the end. It was damn spooky calculating that it would be 2049, exactly 35 years later from then. Of course, I've thought about how long I might live, but I never before thought what actual year might appear on my tombstone. And now, here I really am, and you would think I'd be more scared. But it's more like something abstract is going on. Almost like, see that round table over there? It's still with me. My dad had it until he died. That's the one I wrote about. The would-be murderous table that missed me by inches, and I just marvel. I exist, and almost stopped existing then. I am so amazed at the idea that we exist at all, that we are now here, right at this moment, talking, that the world is here. The truth is, maybe I just can't take in what's happening to me. Can't get my arms around it, can't wrap my mind around it. How can it be that all this existing is going to become non-existing? Or that we will exist but in a way unrelated to anything known? I wonder how she's comparing what I wrote in the book about my imaginary visit with the chaplain with what I'm saying now. Somehow I feel reticent about asking her. Darlene does not let me meander too far from her initial question.
So now tell me, what's it like for you to be visited by the chaplain instead of you being the chaplain and visiting your patients?
She and her swinging necklace settle back in the chair. She waits despite my initial silence. I listen to the exuberant wind outdoors. It has built up like Ravel's bolero. Nature frolics along at a mounting pace, and I start to ever so gradually coast to a stop. Well, I tentatively begin. It's like I don't have to do my leave-taking alone. Like you will walk as far as you can with me, to the very edge, and that you'll wave goodbye even after I can no longer reach you in this dimension. We are almost betwixt and between, aren't we? Darlene is silent before my directness, perhaps feeling helpless, as I so often had, knowing that I could only accompany my patients up to a certain point and they would have to complete the last step beyond where I could go. I resume. I wrote a lot about being at the edge throughout the book. Now here I am at my own ultimate edge, and I'm stuck in the same vacillations I showed in the book. I went back and forth in it about believing and not believing in an afterlife. I still alternate between fear and composure about my own end as I go through the real thing. I'm entranced by the mystery of it all, and yet sometimes I feel indifferent, and sometimes I plain old panic. Ha! How's that for ambivalence? Darlene now picks up on my shift from sadness to the faint but telltale trail of anger I'm leaving in my comments.
So tell me about your ambivalence, she says with an ironical smile.
For some reason, maybe so I won't have to think about my own Act 3, Scene 3 for the moment, I think about the ambivalence I developed toward my chaplain career after about 5 years. I get up for a moment out of my chair to stretch out my legs and then lower myself back down. And as wacky as this may sound, Darlene, that's why I finally switched back to a teaching career. I ended up teaching English to immigrants, first at Hudson County Community College in Union, New Jersey, as I had done there 15 whole years prior. If you'll pardon me for saying so, I became restless with the hospice job because a whole pile of new bureaucratic requirements forced me to visit patients who did not need me there, or from what I could tell, did not even want me there. What I mean is, some patients consistently turned their heads or bodies away from me, or had otherwise sealed themselves in their own world. That world included an opening, if there was one at all, only to loved ones. They could not literally tell me to stop visiting, so the hospice agency requirement was to keep seeing them. How I hated doing this purposeless work. Well, I've griped enough with you. I'm just telling you how hospice changed in those days. But you know what? It sure was revealing how family and friends had reacted to my latest career zigzag back to teaching.
How do you mean?
Darlene looked fully absorbed, I hope I was not rubbing any sore spots in her own work experience. Once again, I had to pause to catch my breath and to husband my energy. When I switched to teaching, the same guy who commented on my book about complicated grief said, "Well, at least you don't have to watch anyone drool anymore." Oh, what an image. I guess he meant there were repulsive or just plain sad elements to the job. And then my brother's reaction was, "It's healthier that you're doing something else now." Funny he said that because the Montanan author Ivan Duig implied the same thing in his novel Work Song. I reach over for a copy of it, the old-fashioned physical print kind, lying on a round green table with fluted sides right next to my chair. I had been rereading it, which is what I always do with good books. I turn to around page 136 and first explain to Darlene before reading it to her that it is about a newcomer in town, staying in a boarding house, who takes up any job he can to pay the rent. He gets hired to represent a funeral home at wakes. After some time, the boarding house matron says that despite the fact that the job brings in the rent, she hints against the reasonableness of that as a lasting occupation. Somewhere soon after that, Duig then says the newcomer leaves that position and takes a job as an assistant librarian. And so I too reached the point, I guess, where hospice was no longer reasonable to continue as a lasting career. Darlene reflects on this and replies, "But I think that's more about how society is uncomfortable with death and the people who have jobs connected with it, like funeral directors and hospice chaplains. But beyond that, what do you think your own deeper reasons for leaving hospice were?" I nod. It's kind of ironic that I picked a vocation where I did lots and lots of serious listening. I had to take people very seriously. When I was growing up, I was not listened to. I was not taken seriously because my parents were too burdened with their own problems to be emotionally available. Well, maybe my choice of profession was not so ironic. I've heard that people try to heal themselves by doing for others what they themselves didn't get. I had to make my own way, with its benefits and burdens. Oh, I just realized something. You asked me why else I left hospice. I think another way to put it is why I returned to teaching. "Uh-huh," she says, probably wondering where my medley of ideas is leading. As much as I was comfortable listening to my clients, sometimes I chafed at having to hold back. I mean, I was always listening, and I had to make space, a sacred space, surely, to make room for their words. But this meant I rarely got to talk, even more rarely talk about myself, and of course never about my own concerns and opinions. I tell you, sometimes this whole listening business is just way too passive. I think I talked more as a teacher during one class meeting than I did for a whole month of patient visits.
"So you had to withdraw yourself in some ways," Darlene suggests. "And of course I know what you mean. It's the only way to be a good chaplain. And the teaching?"
Well, there I did plenty of talking, as I said. I could give of myself through explaining the subject matter, through editing the students' work, through all the pleasure of back-and-forth conversations with individual students. I challenged them. I encouraged them. So you see, I was the one being listened to, paid attention to, and it didn't hurt to be away from all the sad scenes and having to think about death so much. I trail off and fall into a reverie. She strokes my arm and repeats my comment about growing up bereft of proper emotional connections. I explain that if I were to tell her all the peculiar things I had gone through, she, like others who have patiently heard me out, would marvel at my survival and my success. Things like my mother encouraging emotionally lost people to hang around, who as a child I found strange or even threatening. First, I told Darlene about black-haired Ron, who always wore black from turtleneck to shoe, and who felt depressed and tossed around suicidal thoughts from time to time. Mom kept hoping she would help him, and that his conversion to colorful attire would advertise her success. That never happened, as far as I know. The blackness endured. Then there was a Dr. Ferris, who had sunken cheeks like plenty of my patients, smoked a lot, and had a whiny yet lilting voice. He had a substantial piece of rural property where someone took care of his 20-odd cats. I saw them once on a trip out there, stiffly prowling about in their cages, perhaps resentful of their lot. I had puzzled over why he had so many, especially since he did not see them very often. As the king of all hoarders, he even bought a defunct library, the Weiss Library on Old Stereotania Road near Axe Murder Hollow Road in Erie, Pennsylvania, to store all of his detritus in. Eerie legend has it that Weiss Library was haunted along with the Hollow. At least he was kindly. I remember one time he placed some Japanese and Chinese jade figurines on the round marble table and told me about them as I stared at them, entranced. But there were less benign characters than Ferris, and definitely far more disturbing ones than Ron, among Mom's friends who I have classed privately to myself as Mother's coterie, ever since I can remember. These other members spoke loudly, drank copiously, smoked incessantly, and worst of all, made mention of sexual subjects. All of them either had mental illness or some other marginalizing features. Mom, as queen of these remaindered souls, made our home their social center, starting when I was 10, emotionally displacing me to last in line. But worse than that, I tell Darlene, my parents failed to shield me from coterie. Sometimes many of them were visiting all at once, a real witch's Sabbath, if you ever heard of one. Even now, I tremble to speak of it. To top it all off, there was even a person with a murder record who had lengthy telephone conversations with my mother. I read online that about 40 years later, she killed again, involved in a bizarre plot where she forced one of her victims to rob a bank by making him wear a bomb collar that would go off if he did not cooperate within a limited period of time. And he had to carry a cane-shaped shotgun. So awful. In the end, the collar actually exploded and killed the guy. As I'm telling this to Darlene, I remember this crime grabbed national media attention. Wikipedia reports that the CNN television news show Anderson Cooper 360 highlighted the story as one of the FBI's most mysterious cases. What an Adams family existence I had. But actually, such a family as the one in that TV show would have done a better job of taking care of me because of their compassion for each other and their visitors, their relatively safer environment, and their joy at being who they were. Because of my childhood setting, I conclude to my chaplain, I've often said that my epitaph should read, "Against all odds." She falls silent with a rapt expression. What is she thinking? The jazzy, improvised dance of conversation is such a mysterious process. She says softly, "Karen, you sure did survive against incredible odds. I can scarcely fathom how you made this amazing achievement of rising above adversity. And not just to get by, but to excel in so many ways, emotional, intellectual, and spiritual. After years of chaos with your mom's not only odd, but downright dangerous coterie, you managed to beat all the odds against achieving high self-esteem. Meanwhile, contributing to society, being creative and flourishing alongside your loving husband since 1989. Against all odds sure should be your motto." I look at her, waiting. I'm tempted to just close my eyes. I have dug down so much. Then I meet Darlene's compassionate blinking eyes and see her hands rub her cheeks. I see my own sadness entering her burdened eyes, her face, her fingertips. Then she asks in the gentlest voice, "Karen, how did you beat such daunting odds as those?" I don't fully know. This whole business has puzzled me so much. Because of another question. How come some people are not resilient enough to recover from the damage? You know, I did come to something of an answer for a memorial service I'll never forget. The man who died was a public figure who himself had suffered multiple kinds of adversity, like poverty, medical problems, and ethnic discrimination. But he flourished and became world-renowned. He wrote an autobiography, and he pondered his own resilience, just like I'm doing now for myself. The survivors have requested I do not allude to his identity. Anyway, in my invocation, you can read it for yourself. It's in the file marked Eulogies over there in that metal cabinet. Look under E. Darlene goes over and gets it and reads aloud a few phrases from the end. "Seized upon his own internal flame that had been waiting to illuminate his life purpose, each of us has a flame residing within. It may be sputtering, it may be tamped down by malicious moisture, but with the unfaltering fan of passion, each of our own flames will blaze their way into a most exalted and full and bountiful panorama of light." "You see," I continue as she looks up from the text, "this sort of says if too much moisture is dumped on the flame that we all have, then we don't make it. And believe me, I've met plenty of people like that. Like Mom's emotionally ill friends, for starters. It's the saddest thing for me to come across people who can't surmount their past." I pause, thinking of something I read in a John Cheever's novel, The Wapshot Scandal, where he talked about such people. We are all ransomed to our beginnings, and for some people, The sum might be exorbitant. I then add, those people have permanently fallen in a pit, and I cannot reach them and pull them out. And sometimes I feel afraid as I think how precariously close I myself have been many times to tumbling right down into the pit with them permanently and being trapped there. But somehow, for some people like me, even a faltering flame can keep on going because of the passion inside there that fans it. Though I guess that still leaves the mystery of where the passion comes from. I pause to catch my breath. I ramble on. It's tempting to say it's from God. But then I don't understand why some people's destiny is to have enough passion to overcome the bad stuff, while others are not so lucky. Darlene ponders this, but she sees I'm way too tired to continue and tells me she can come back another time. Then, in the ensuing quiet after she closes the front door after herself, I think to myself, the factors that allowed me out of the hole, the pit, like Joseph was in, have varied over the different stages of my life. Like when I was a child at home, my family revered fine music and classic literature. I transcended my otherwise cramped emotional space by soaring into uplifting music and losing myself in the emotionally safe world of literature. A cherished memory is of my father frequently playing a recording of an opera and giving me the libretto complete with translation to follow along as I sat in an easy chair with an ottoman. For some reason, it sticks in my mind that one of the records was made of red vinyl, unlike all the other black ones, which fascinated me to no end. I eventually became familiar with the melodies of over 100 classical pieces, which has given me the lifelong pleasure of recognizing them when played on the radio or at concerts. Another pleasant memory I have is of the whole immediate family, the four of us reading books at the same time in the living room, a rare oasis of mutual quiet enjoyment. My mother was an avid reader of such authors as John Updike, Saul Bellow, and Philip Roth. She not only wrote to some of them, but at least one, Saul Bellow, even replied to her insightful comments. A handwritten letter of his, which is in my brother's custody, includes the comment that rabbis are to God what brokers are to real estate. I've seldom known them to be very godly. My response to that sentiment is, how? Perhaps this literary milieu is what led me at around age 12 to plunge into creative writing, finding haven in the arts on the other side of the pen, so to speak. Then starting in high school, I constructed my own inner orderly world out of academic pursuits. I wrote highly detailed essays on literature and philosophy. I wrote poems and dreamed of making my mark on the world as a writer. My English literature teacher, Sister Lisa Mary, her initials expanded to SLIM behind her back, had us try out Faulkner's free association technique. Part of what I wrote was, I know the inside world quite well, but not the outside. In a psychological study, they said children are not as aware as adults. They live in a daze. Well, I'm still a child then, but in socially acceptable ways, in that I am a would-be writer. That's why I'm proud of my introspective impression. But as far as dealing with feelings, the unspoken mantra growing up was, don't feel, or at the very least, put your feelings on hold. And so, deprived of my emotional legacy, as a young child, I coped by withdrawing. Not the healthiest strategy, I well realize, but one of the few available to me at the time. I spent a lot of time alone and was shy around most people. On the plus side, I think my withdrawing deeply into myself made for the rich internal world that subsequently gave me the makeup for being a chaplain, writer, and teacher. Left primarily to my own devices, I kept myself going during my college years by setting high academic goals, plus the extensive traveling I had done. Puerto de la Libertad in El Salvador. And Kurashiki, Japan, where I had taught English as a second language. Looking back, I had put my writing and love of words into an academic straitjacket, which I did not toss away until I resumed my creative writing 4 decades later in my mid-50s. Despite my achievements, including Phi Beta Kappa and graduating with highest honors from Oberlin College, the lack of the proper taking in and letting out of emotions had taken an exorbitant toll, which only became greater as time went on. For most people, feeling emotions is as automatic as breathing. For me, I have to often remind myself to be in touch with what I'm feeling. It was only through the gentle, ongoing work of several compassionate therapists and friends that by my 50s, I was at last able to claim the non-intellectual part of my inheritance that every child has a right to. A couple of weeks later, Darlene drops in for a second visit. It takes me a little longer than last time to rise from my cushioned chair, go step by step to the door, and tug it open. I am stubborn about programming it to open on its own. I do not want technology to coddle me to death like in Stanislaw Lem's cautionary tales about the search for happiness in his science fiction work, The Cyberiad. I offer her some tea and dried fruit, and then sit back down to wait and see what she will say. A little contest of silence ensues between us until she asks, "What are you thinking about now?" I reply with a chuckle that I'm waiting for her to speak first, since that was what I was used to doing when I was a chaplain. That is what I did to ensure that clients would talk about what they needed to talk about. Darlene chuckles in return and then skillfully takes that to a meaningful level.
What do you need to talk about?
I do not especially feel like digging too much psychologically or releasing the tears demanding their exit upon hearing her words, but her simply asking me what I need is a hook. It is not often that someone wants to stay the course with me past the small talk, so despite some fatigue, I soldier on. As a child, I had to fall back on my own world. Like I said, my mother was busy with her coterie, and my father had his own preoccupations, so they could not emotionally be around for me very often. There hardly ever were any wholesome people around. I remember whenever I saw an unexpected car pull into our driveway, my spirits rose as I wondered who could be visiting us. But every time the car pulled back out because the driver was only there to turn around and go in the opposite direction, which left me marooned once again. I was left to my own devices and did not fit into the social world of other children, and so I was betwixt and between, neither fully here nor there, neither fully within the family circle at home, nor in the wider world outside the home. Darlene interrupts.
You know, there is a really, really sad paragraph in your Upward Spiral story. I went back after our last visit and looked it up, about your feeling shut out. You know which one I mean?
I sure do. That was a true part about when my mom locked me outside for a little while so she could yak on the phone. I get a copy of the story on my nearby screen, direct it to the right paragraphs, and I show it to Darlene. She reads it out loud.
When I was about 8, my mom had me go in the back porch, and she locked not one but both parts of the Dutch door that stood between it and the dining room. I banged and banged on the window and hollered to be let in. How I loathed the idea that she willfully kept talking and kept ignoring me as if I were not standing out there. Nothing, not my own voice nor even my outraged tears, reached her as her laughter applauded the merry comments of her friend.
I sigh. I sure do sound forlorn there. Darlene looks at me to see how this registers on me. I sigh again and say, as nasty as my mother sounds there, in the long run, it was a good thing that she shut me out sometimes. Being in the family circle was not a good place for me to be. I began to sense later on that I not only did not want to be included, but that I wanted to steer way clear of it. I guess I got used to looking at just about everything at a distance. My family, children at school, other adults. So later in life, I guess that's why I like taking the stance of an observer. I used to love studying anthropology. I could relate to how the researcher talked about their subjects. Chaplaincy, and writing too, is about closely observing the world, which takes some distancing. Darlene nods her understanding and finishes off her by now tepid tea. She's a good sport to do that. I like mine steaming hot. She responds,
I think the distancing you're talking about has kept you good and far from the edge of the pit. That's scary. Dangerous pit.
I'm uneasy. She's bringing me near that pit again, which I have worked all my life to edge away from and not topple back into. It's one thing to live along the edge, quite another to lose balance and go over it, or even linger there too long. I say, this makes me think about the Joseph story, where his brothers throw him into a pit. There's no water in it, and maybe predators could go there and have themselves a feast.
Speaking of food, she replies, you know what happens next in the story. The very next thing is that the Bible says his brothers went ahead and had a meal. Who could eat after doing what they did to their own brother, which was more or less a death sentence?
Worse than that, I say. I remember some commentators said the brothers quickly walked far from the pit and got busy with other things so they wouldn't hear Joseph's cries of distress. I felt myself simmering, my own distress surging through my flushed skin. My anger mounts as I recalled my inability for my anguish to get through to my parents. To either one. Not only was I left in the pit, not only did my parents walk away, they came back over to make sure I stayed down there. They did not want me to escape. They could not escape their own pit which they were in, and they wanted me to stay next door in my own. But I did escape away. Maybe a vestige of me remains in it, but damn it, I clambered out and helped many people out of their own pits. Yes, that is what I did, and that is what my story you just read from is about. All of a sudden, spent, I feel a fierce urge to sleep, and I have to tell Darlene I'm too tired to talk anymore. You're welcome to stay, but I won't be very interesting to you asleep. I'm only half joking. As I drift off, not too concerned whether Darlene is still there or not, I think about how I have explained the story title, Upward Spiral. It's about what I just said to Darlene. It suggests a positive, although ambivalent, journey to a better emotional and spiritual place. The many circuitous turns of the narrator in her journey, which of course was psychologically my own, hampered my progress. My own resistance and that of others added to the steepness of the climb. There were my downward moments, but more or less, I kept to an upward pattern. I think, too, about Joseph in the pit, and how he ultimately made it out of there emotionally as well as physically. Not only that, he transcended his shortcomings to forgive his family and rescue them and countless others from famine. A couple of weeks after the chaplain's previous visit, I hear the welcome knock on the door. I do not mind that my husband saves me the trouble of having to make the long trek all the way there to open it. As she comes in, she greets him with a hug before he goes off to another room. He senses that I need some private time to talk with her, as does he, as he had done last time after I fell asleep. This visit, she recognizes that the length of time I can talk at each visit is shorter, understanding that I must spend my verbal coins economically. So Darlene gets down to important matters. "What's most on your mind today?" she asks. I do not take the easy way out by wasting the offering of rich interaction by mentioning something mundane, like what I would be eating for dinner. I figure I might as well give her a run for her money and go for the really deep stuff. "I think the path of my life has been one long contest between breaking free of anxiety and embracing the moment. Anxiety has robbed me of peace and joy. I often missed out on the riches of the moment." My tears demanded their freedom and finally win it, right while I'm saying this to her. After the reluctant teardrops all land peacefully on my hand-embroidered shirt, she quotes the poet Debbie Perlman, "Your tears are jewels." As more jewels join their fellows upon my shirt, I feel my head clear. I suddenly want to tell her my latest conclusions about God. "You know what I think God is all about? God is not a commander or being who rescues people or doesn't rescue people. God does not grant wishes or punish or watch indifferently from up high. God is here wherever living things forge a connection between each other that brings out their best or lets them be authentic. I think God is about what makes living things want to continue living and drives non-living things to become living ones. Like when I connected in an authentic way with my patients, and of course with my husband Steve. And when people like you are connecting with me, God is here. Even when we make healing connections within ourselves that help us know ourselves more and care more about ourselves and others, that's when God is present. Or maybe I should say I am more aware of God's presence at such moments. I believe God is always present, but usually unnoticed and somehow subconsciously registered in the brain. You know, this is like the instruments in an orchestra that play the background parts that enrich the sounds of the ones playing the melody and act as a backdrop for the soloists. "You say you feel a presence right now with us?" she asks. "Yes," I respond, because I do feel myself clutching at these remaining moments of life. Even now, I feel as if you, this room, this house, all the loved ones in it, all my previous thoughts and memories of all connection are receding. They're getting smaller, as if I were in a train, seated facing the caboose, feeling pulled backwards and even further away from all of this as the train speeds forward. Darlene and I sit placidly in the quiet for a very long time. Steve comes back in to join the welcoming silence. Steve and I have always liked interludes of quiet. I take in the small noises in the background. The wind is rattling the impatient leaves. A lawnmower's bass voice crescendos and decrescendos as it mows nearer and further and nearer again, off and on, drowning out the bird calls. These sounds and movements are richer than any symphony and as dramatic as any action film. I see sparrows in the wake of the mower's progress go in a jagged line of jumps, contrasted with the obedient, steady itinerary of passerby on the boardwalk. I feel the rise and fall of my chest and abdomen as I breathe, all of this sensation as infinitely captivating as the exotica of my extensive travels. Quiet places have been my refuge and my meeting place for fanning my internal flame of passion. The silence here is sacred, be held reverently by us as I prepare to dwell in the burgeoning stillness to come.